Monstrey, Girl, Alva, Ridge, Pihu, Deira Tranja, Petra, Happy as Lazaro. One of those is going to be our film of the year, but which one? The only person I can do this with is Ben Woodywis. Ben, hello.
Hello, welcome.
Welcome to my own podcast. And you welcome to mine, and everybody, of course, welcome along. Now, I'm not going to go over the rules. If you're wondering why The Irishman isn't on that list, well, you really haven't been around here for more than 5 minutes, have you? Because we don't do mainstream Hollywood films on this podcast. This is the best film of the year list on the planet right now, Ben. There is no doubt about this.
No.
No. Simply no debate about it. So this is what we've got. And yes, there are a bunch of one-worldy titles. We've never had so many one-worded film titles on a list before. That's pretty funky. But anyway, this is what we've got. But before we get to that, and believe me, it's worth the wait, Ben, we've got another list to get through, haven't we?
Yes, the Oscar nominations.
Foreign language Oscar nominations. Yeah. Now, this is the semi-final stage, as people probably know at this stage of the year. We're not quite there for the final five or six to put forward. So any of these could make it through to the final stage. We'll do most of them, if not all of them, on the podcast next year, as we always do, Ben. Yeah. But if I can just kind of ask you to like summarise what you think of the list as a whole.
It's World War II heavy. It's past heavy. Yep. I thought there was a lot of that going on. The standout for me, because I watched all the trailers, and the one that really I thought, yes, I'm up for seeing this, is the Polish entry called Christy. I love me a bit of a grey area central character, good and bad. And Corpus Christi has that in spades. I think transgressive, headbutting priest. I've got a lot of time for that. Also, I don't know if you thought this, but the guy, the central character in Corpus Christi, has got a lot of young Christopher Walken going on in those eyes, which was cool. Honeyland is probably quite interesting as well. I don't know. Just been doing a lot of talking about bees and difficult to reach hives, and that was fun to see. And I quite like the trailer for Beanpole, the Russian entry as well. Probably not the most enjoyable viewing experience, but, you know, whatever. My least favourite by a country mile is The Painted Bird. I don't want to see that.
Well, the interesting thing is that obviously we've got our new co-presenter, Lee, who is from the Czech Republic or in the Czech Republic.
Oh, okay, but then he's the obvious choice for The Painted Bird. He can watch the Julian Sands movies.
Indeed. The thing is, we always try to make predictions on these lists, and it's a crapshoot because they never quite do what you expect. We can always predict the winner, always. That is almost a 9 times out of 10 accuracy. This, however, is almost impossible always.
Isn't Parasite going to be the winner?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, as you say, World War is back. It had a year off last year, but it's well and truly back this year. So, you know, they've more than made up for it this time. You know, three of that entire list, which I should read out now, actually. It's Painted Bird for Czech Republic, Truth and Justice from Estonia, another film called Les Miserables from France.
It's nothing to do with any previous Les Miserables that people
Why would you do it, France? Why would you do it? Those Who Remained from Hungary. Yeah. As you mentioned, Honeyland, which is from North Macedonia now. They're an independent new country. Interesting. Yep, you mentioned Corpus Christi from Poland, Beanpole from Russia, Parasite from South Korea, you've mentioned, which won the Palme d'Or. So I think you have to consider that as almost a shoe-in for the final foreign language Oscar list. Atlantics from Senegal, which is there just to keep the quote-unquote world thing going and won't make it any further. And if it does, we know why, to keep the world thing going.
Won a lot at Sundance, though, right?
Which they love.
Yeah.
It's their festival that they regard as, you know, the festival for indie films, which it used to be, but it's not anymore, that's for sure. And then to finish off with Pain and Glory, which... not only has the kind of inward-looking, kind of directorial self-referential thing, which Hollywood loves.
Yeah.
It loves that. It's also got Antonio Banderas in, which Hollywood loves even more, Ben. So
not looking as old as you might expect him to look, funnily enough.
But they do love him nonetheless. And they'll have him in any kind of film that they can have him in, really. So I think we can safely say, and I say that, as you can tell, with a slight... change of voice, we can safely say that Parasite and Pain of Glory will probably reach the final list for this thing, but Julieta from Almodóvar didn't, Ben. And that was a surprise to me initially a couple of years ago. Julieta was a really good film that I thought, this has got Hollywood all over it. It's made by people that Hollywood people know. So therefore, I thought that was a shoo-in. But it didn't even make it through to the final list. So will Pain and Glory suffer the same fate? I'd be surprised. And I think this might even be the guilt one. Where Juliet didn't, so therefore this one did.
Yes.
This one will. Definitely. So, but apart from that, I think it's, who knows? I mean, surely not all three of the war films will make it through to the final list. So one of them is going to make it, but we don't know which one. Will they support Russia, considering everything that's going on politically at the moment? Who knows?
No.
I mean, you can almost guarantee that'll be the best of all the war films, because it's going to have a bigger budget behind it, and it'll be more balls to the wall as all the others will, because it's Russia.
And it's less beautified as well.
Yes. Other ones,
they've got this kind of glorious golden past kind of wash all over them, which I find a bit distasteful when you're doing World War II films. We don't need a come and see remake where everyone looks cute and pretty.
No, and they do that all the time anyway. It's an interesting list in the sense that the reason that the list is put together as it is, and the nomination procedure for this, and this, I think they've changed it recently, 1 or 2 years ago, where you can only vote for films for this category, and I think some other categories as well, but especially this one, if you've seen it theatrically.
Mm.
Now, that's obviously an extremely unfair procedure, because how many American cinemas are going to show the latest film from Afghanistan, or are going to show the latest film from Latvia? However, you could say the same for Estonia, Ben.
Mm.
You could say the same for North Macedonia.
Festival screenings here for a theatrical.
I think that's theatrical screenings in a way that may also include festivals.
Yeah,
so it actually fills me with some sort of hope, Ben. You're never going to hit your correct list for this, because too many people just won't get a fair crack. But for the fact that people in America are broadcasting films from Estonia, North Macedonia, the Czech Republic, I mean, this is good, right?
Yeah, no, this is positive.
I mean, this is also the first year, and I think only the second time in the last 5 years that nothing from Scandinavia is on the list at all. Which is interesting, but that also tells me again, you can guarantee the Scandinavian stuff will come over to America, because it always does. So these films beat the Scandinavian films for this list, and they've had an equal shot. And it's these that have won out. So, again, nothing against... not obviously slighting anything Scandinavian, of course, because we love it. You all know that I love it dearly so. But I have reasons to believe that this is the most fair and honest list the Academy's put together for a while. Now, what they do with it after that, we'll find out, and is up to them. But it does fill me with a tiny bit of hope. Now, it's a very dangerous thing to say, Ben, but, you know, maybe.
I hear you. Guarded trust.
Indeed. Like anyway, we shall see what happens with that. But first, we have some things to deal with. And the first biggest one of all, of course, is the reason that you're all here. It's the flagship episode. It's the one that justifies the whole damn thing. week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out, since 2014. It's the film of the year. This is the episode that the entire podcast hangs on, because this is why we say that, you know, this is the film of the year list to get behind, because this is real films. These are real cinema. This ain't kind of marketed. It ain't necessarily out of here purely to make money. There's no evil behind any of it. There's no capitalist kind of overly capitalist nature behind all of it. And yes, people want to make money from films, of course.
Yeah.
But these are when art and the actual storytelling and movie making all comes into one glorious thing. World cinema. This are the best eight that we've managed to come together and put together for you, for us to now dissect one by one. And of course, you can expect spoilers, because you've had all year to watch these films. So it just makes it easier for us to obviously talk about them. So if you want to watch any of these before we talk about them, now would be the chance, and then come back to us. Let's start off with Monstry, Ben. Let's start off with Monstry, which is a damn good place to start for me. And I kind of made this known quite early on in the year that this would probably end up on the film of the year list, and here it is. It's a Romanian film about a couple, Dana and Artur, and essentially 24 hours in their life when they both decide to try other things to see how they really feel each other. I feel about each other, I should say. That's pretty much a basic synopsis of the film. There's a lot more to it than that, though, Ben.
you don't even realise they're together for about the first, like, third to half of the movie. You don't realise this is a couple, necessarily.
Indeed not. And we'll come on to how they frame that in a minute. But for me, it's a film about social customs in Romania, which is fair enough, and that would be an interesting film in itself. But what elevates it to a borderline masterpiece level for me, Ben, is that it's a film about social customs in film.
Yes.
The film is essentially split into three parts. The first part is Dana, who gets in a taxi but refuses to go back to her own apartment, and she sort of ends up spending practically all evening with some taxi driver. Now, it's the kind of scene that you've seen umpteen times before. You're kind of waiting for something to happen, some sort of romantic thing to happen between the pair of them or something along those lines. But not a lot actually does happen.
No.
The second act is Arthur, who ends up meeting somebody off Grindr. But this time, stuff does happen, but it's not what you actually expect to happen. No. And the film kind of concludes with the pair of them back together, and we learn how they now plan or don't plan to move on from their kind of current and past misdemeanours. And the way they go about this journey, it's fairly straightforward in structure, but it's certainly not straightforward in the way that it's technically put together, which is the best thing. And, the best thing about a great film... technically, it's got so much to say. Like the individual chapters, starting off with Dana, moving on to Arthur, the framing is very narrow, making it all about them as people and their world, not about anything else. It's just about them. And then for the part three, when they get back together to kind of see how things are going to go forward, the lens widens. You know, it's sort of gimmicky to explain. It does sound gimmicky, but it just works perfectly well when you watch the film.
Yeah, it really does.
And it's the language of the film. The language of the film is largely dominated by the way that it's shot and the way that it's framed, which is absolutely awesome to me. But going back to like the social customs of Romania and stuff, like the repartee that takes place between Dana and the taxi driver, you know, so dry. And that's what I love Romanian cinema for. It's always so dry. Like there's a moment, you know, encapsulated by the moment at the beginning where she gets in a taxi and she asks the driver to take her to her location, which is her own apartment. He says to her, and I'm paraphrasing, well, I would go there if you actually would have asked me before getting in the taxi. So then she actually gets out. She takes her luggage out of the taxi with her, goes and stands on the street for about a minute or two, then returns to exactly the same taxi and asks exactly the same question, except she does it in the way that pleases him. Before she got in the taxi, she asked him. So
yes,
therefore,
he
did take her to where he wanted to go. It's the social thing. It's just like fascinating. Like you can just tell it's such a Romanian attitude to have. It's absolutely, you know, as I say, fascinating to see. Likewise, in the next part with Arthur, who goes around someone's apartment, who he meets off Grindr. You know, the conversation that takes place is not the conversation you're expecting to take place for a movie like this and for a genre like this. You know, wiping the beer cans for hygiene, like, and not only that, but when the guy who isn't Arthur, he goes and gets himself a beer can, like you think that would be that, but no, Arthur actually makes the point. Did you wipe that can yourself then? It's just a level of, you know, banality that is just superb in this film. And then of course, right, and like kind of the drinking of the beer itself, like Arthur gets accused of not being the responsible one, even though he's having something to eat and having one beer. But then the guy he meets with has a beer. So that means neither of them are being responsible, and yet what happens afterwards is absolutely responsible, because nothing actually happens at all, hardly.
And there's that cake thing as well.
Yeah.
The whole focus on the cake.
Yeah. So the lack of literal climax to the whole scene and pretty much the whole film is just baffling in an amazing way to me. It's nothing that I've quite seen for quite some time. The whole film basically has become over to you, Ben. It's basically a complete shake-up of the audience expectations. At every stage of this film, it's almost entirely a subversion of the norm, mixed with dry humour and a lack of small talk from Romanian customs. I really did enjoy the film, Ben.
It stands up really well to a second screening. I think on top of everything that you've said as well, there's you get films which are made in a particular technical way, which might be distracting, but the techniques, the how this is made and the why this is made, don't interfere with what's going on. They just kind of add to it. Yep. So the framing device is the big one, where it goes from one by one to widescreen as it goes on. I think if memory serves, towards the end of the film, it starts losing the widescreen when they start talking about shoes again.
Yes, when, and there's a dance they have together, and it goes really square then.
Yeah.
You've got to fit two heads in the shot, so it really focuses around the dance that they're doing. Yeah.
There's a real technical focus on the story here. It's not just glossy showmanship at all. And in addition to that, there's a really interesting color play with this film. It's very, very simple color scheme, but it's played very well. People have motif colors, and bright colors are a big part of this film. In a landscape that isn't always that bright, is often quite muted, but these characters are kind of a picture to something else, which is lovely. For me, the things that really stuck out to me were the technical aspects, the color and the way it's shot, and what you see and what you don't see, what is said and what is not said. All of those things really got me for this film. My favorite scene, again, coming back second time, is the scene with Arta's grandmother.
Oh, of course.
That is the standout moment for me, because that kind of explains, that has the most to say about their relationship, about the success and failure of their relationship, I think. The kind of family idea of what a relationship is for and what's expected of it. You know, you've got your audience expectations watching this film. Romania has its own expectations of what a relationship is for, why people would do it in the first place, which is pictured as being very old-fashioned. This is the old lady's point of view. It's in the past. It's perhaps irrelevant now. It's certainly irrelevant in that Dana and Arta don't seem to live the life that the grandmother is talking about at all. But this isn't put to her at all. She's just allowed to sit there and come out with all her kind of her ideas of what a couple is.
Yeah.
And they don't question it at all, but you're questioning it with everything that you've seen prior to this scene and everything that you'll see afterwards.
I mean, we'll be moving on to, in a few films' time, the father of the year in films that everybody wants in their life, or should have in their life, if possible. What we have here is the grandmother of the year in films, but you do not want this grandmother.
No, this is the... This is your friend's racist grandma.
I mean, she's hilarious, and it's a real welcome. I mean, it's full of dry humour, but to actually have some belly laughs is welcome in such a, you know, to call it miserable is harsh, but it is a bleak movie in that sense. A wonderfully bleak one. That I mean, for me, Ben, as a final point for me before we move on, you can of course come back in if you wish, but for me, this is like a softer Haneke film. Like, it's about audience expectations. It's about challenging them in all sorts of technical and narrative structure ways. But it's also in the fact that everything actually means something. Like, there's something in pretty much every scene that makes you go, and one of them that stands out to me is probably my most interesting scene for me, is when it comes to the discussion of children later on in the film. And they're at a party, and there's kind of like, Donna's kind of struggling to hold conversations surrounded by people her age who have all got children.
Yeah,
and all that kind of thing. But the camera cuts to a single red balloon floating, or not floating, just reaching the top of the ceiling that they're in. One single red balloon. Like, you know, is that the child that got away? She happens to be wearing red as well. So it's little touches of that would elevate the film from being a great film to a borderline masterpiece for me. It's just full of nuance and full of little things like that. No matter, you go, yes.
See, I thought the red balloon was her.
It could be
that she's breaking away.
It could be, absolutely.
The expectation,
and like all truly great films, the room for interpretation is there. Whether that is her breaking away, whether it's a lost child, either way, Red's involved, so you know it is to do with her.
Yeah,
it's a great film. Truly great film, deserves to be on this list. There's nothing much else to be said, and I want to do some more Romanian films as I want to do often. It's just that so few of them actually get to come over. But I like Romanian cinema.
I'd like to see where this guy goes next.
Exactly, absolutely. One to watch out, as there are a whole bunch of Romanian auteurs out there that have actually got something to say and a way of saying it. So, yes, I'll sort of make a pledge that we're going to do some more Romanian stuff next year. Yes, please, if possible. Moving on then, Ben. We've already mentioned it already, actually, in that sense, the father of the year. We'll keep this one a little bit more brief since we discussed it most recently, but since that episode will be deleted for all time, we may as well give it a good old go anyway once again. It's Girl. What have we got here?
So Girl is the story of a 15-year-old trans girl Born a boy, but now in the body of a girl, played by Victor Bolster. This is Lara, who is moving into ballet. I can't remember actually if so. She's got a background in dance, but not in classical ballet. And the film follows her attempts. She's managed to get into a ballet school, and it kind of runs parallel both the experience of the ballet school, where she has to push herself a little bit harder because she hasn't had the experience that the other girls have had. Oh, what a metaphor! while all the same time getting ready for her operations. Getting onto meds and just living the life of a young trans woman. For me, it's a beautiful kind of dovetailing of a narrative, physical performance storyline with an internal biological storyline. I feel like these two things for me, they connected really well. That's why this film is back for me. I really like the way that the body and wanting something is not enough. You have to put a lot of work into it. How these two things just feed into each other really well. And Father of the Year as well. Lara's dad is just wonderful. He's just everything you want to see from a father in a movie. He's supportive. He's there. He pushes her to be more open with him. I found this film deeply affecting. It's got that kind of oh god, what are they called? I've drawn a blank. Those brothers who make films.
The Dardenne brothers.
The Dardenne brothers. It's got a super Dardenne brothers feel to it for me. Hmm. I'd like to see what Lucas Daunt does next, to see if this is this like how he makes films, or is this how he made this particular film. I think a huge amount of this film hangs on Victor Polster playing the lead character. I know that there was a huge backlash against this film, that they didn't get a trans person to play the lead character. But this is a very, very difficult role to get. You need someone who can dance really well, and also someone who looks androgynous, and also someone who is a teenager. That's a very, very, very small pool of talent that you can get there. And I think Victor Polster does amazingly well with this role. It's got a very unpleasant ending, which might be one thing, might be something else. I'm no spoilers here.
Oh, no, spoilers all the way. That's what we're here for on this episode.
Beddies.
Is it suicide? Is it chemical based? Is it just nothing at all? Could be any of those things.
It is. I mean, I have an idea about what he's doing at the end there, and why all the kind of backlash against this film is pointless, because I don't think he was jeopardizing any future surgery. I think he was doing something else. But I think he was doing something that means he has to be fast-tracked.
Exactly.
On the road to surgery.
I don't think the ending is as nuanced as you think it is. I think it's fairly straightforward. Where he stabs, we don't know. Or she stabs, I should say. Where she stabs, we don't know. But it is just to push things along at a far, far quicker pace. That's whether it's it's a particular body part against another body part, we can debate that. But it's kind of pointless. The procedure is what it is, and that's that, really.
Yeah, but I don't know. This was a really good film for me.
I'm not passionately against the film, as if people do remember. I'm not really angrily against it. It just needed to be better for me. Like, the problem I have above all else is that this is actually not a documentary of Nora Monseca, who is who he met in the airport, was inspired by the story of how she became a trans ballet dancer, and that's where this film came from. Now, Lara is not Nora. Lara is Lara, and I don't like the storytelling of Lara in this film. Now, if you were to say this is based on a true story, and if you were to say that this character is Nora, you can get away with so much more. However, this is Lara. Lara's an independent person, and I don't agree with the structure and how and the quality of technical kind of nuance behind it either, necessarily, which we'll come on to. Yeah. But I just don't like the use of Lara in this film. There are too many repeated scenes of Lara in this film. You know, we get it, pinning your penis back. Once is fine, twice you're pushing it. More than that, please. There's far too much body stuff. We get all that. Too many ballet scenes as well, however, that repeat the same point we understand. It's a struggle. We get it. We got that after the first 10 minutes, then after the first 20, then after half an hour, then after 40, etc. There's just too much repeating of scenes for me, and that remains the case. I get it. It tries to straddle the lines between physiological, emotional, and psychological. And it does an okay job doing that. There's a balance of all three of them. But again, should have been a better balance. Should have been more variety of scenes. Even more so, considering the, as you say correctly, excellent performance from Victor Polster. Really? So for a debut, it's fine. Don't get me wrong. I'm not completely against it. It's fine. But for his next film, I want better. There is no doubt about that. It was a sloppily handled film for me, this.
I mean, I would say that the repetition is this is what Lara's life is. Lara's life is taping back her penis, doing ballet, doing things. It's the same every day, and all she wants is for things to change. But they will only change if you keep slogging away at it. And this is the message that I think a lot of young people need to hear, is that they have to keep putting their shoes on and keep doing stuff. And
but
keep
I want things to change. I want things to change by seeing new fucking scenes in this movie, Ben.
Argue. I see your point, and I rate you love.
No, I mean, it's an entirely fair point, and your praise is also entirely fair as well. Yeah, it's just whether you can tolerate the journey of this particular Lara. And again, as great as his performance was of her, too much repetition for me. And
there is a lot of repetition. It's a film based on repetition.
Exactly.
So
and again, like you, it's 1 hour 40, which is just about in the kind of field of happiness for me, between 1 hour 20 and 1 hour 40, which we'll come on to a few times on this list. Ooh. A film needn't be any longer than that kind of window, really. And this is just in that window. But still, it could have had 10, 20 minutes chopped off. One or two less penis scenes, one or two less ballet scenes, and it would have felt a bit more sharper, which would have then fit in with the harshness of the ending.
I mean, this film does chop something off in the end. Woo-hoo.
Yes, and but the actual final scene is quite the bizarre thing. It seems out of place to me, Ben.
Fair dude. Yeah.
I mean, do you felt that they kind of shot that at the beginning and put it at the end, or just at a different point? I mean, you know.
I thought that was clearly a scene for another point in the movie that had been shuffled around. I think that was an ending that was created in the edit.
Yes.
I think they felt that where they ended it was a bit too harsh, so they picked it up again for a kind of happier ending. I could be wrong.
I mean, the happy ending thing is shooting for the very, very wrong thing here, because she's stabbed herself, and now she's happy. Not a good message, really.
Look, no, and again, a big part of the backlash was about that as well.
Understandably. That's fine. But yes, film, weird. But then, fine as well. Anyway, look forward to his next one. Maybe.
Yeah.
Alva. From Portugal, Alva. A farmer named Henrique commits a felony and hides in the forest before eventually returning home. Sound about right?
I think you... No, that's it. Yeah.
Now, the first time I saw this really blew my mind. Second time, a little bit less so. However, it remains a hell of a thing, Ben, which is why I'm going to come straight over to you, because I want you to give a review of this that I think I myself gave when I saw it for the first time. It's a hell of a thing, as I say.
It really is. I was very surprised. So you've seen this twice. I've only seen this film once.
Yeah.
I was not expecting this at all. I thought it was going to be something quite different. I found this really... I need to see this again. But I found this really interesting. So the official summary of this film is, after committing a crime, Enrique, a man in his 30s, hides in the forest.
I would never have had him in his 30s, you see. Never have had him in his 30s. Yes,
that is the one thing I disagree with hugely. This man is clearly in his 40s. If he's in his 30s, he's had a rough life.
Obviously, being a farmer in Portugal is a very rough life.
Absolutely. And also, why is him being in his 30s relevant in any way whatsoever?
Indeed.
Sure. So, Enrique commits a crime. There is a brief conversation scene that he has with a lady. That's one of the only conversation scenes in this film.
Yes, absolutely.
And he then runs off to the forest to hide there in a number of different landscapes, some of them wet with water, some of them dry without water. Sometimes he stands up and sometimes he lies down.
Oh, he does quite a lot of lying down, actually.
He does do a fair bit of lying. sometimes he walks and sometimes he stands still. And eventually he goes back and has a complete change of clothes and goes to a cafe. Spoiler alert, it ends with a cafe with a very intriguing POV shot. Indeed. That'll get you thinking, even if you think it won't.
Yeah.
I really dug this. I was in I was not in a mood for a lot of plot and a lot of dialogue when I sat down to watch this. And Alpha delivers if you don't want either of those two things, because there is not a lot of plot and there is not a lot of dialogue in this film. It all kind of hangs on how well you enjoy watching Henrique, your protagonist. Is that even his name?
Yep.
Wandering around the forest, because that's what this film is.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. not much to add. It's made by someone called Iko Costa, and I'm intrigued to know if this is a relative of Pedro Costa.
That's too obvious, Ben. I'm not having that. I can't guarantee whether that's true or false, but that is so obvious, I'm not having it.
I know. Well, I'm going to have to look this up because I'm slightly intrigued. It doesn't say anything here, but it feels like a Pedro Costa film. If anyone's watched any Pedro Costa, Portuguese filmmaker who hates dialogue.
Indeed.
It has that kind of feel to it.
That's too much of a coincidence. Life doesn't always, life can be like that sometimes, but let's be fair, it often isn't. So
maybe Costa nice is like Mick in Portugal or something. So it's just like everyone is called Costa. and it's shot on 16mm as well, which was another real standout for me. I'm really enjoying people going back to 16mm. This film has a kind of difficult to place time feel to it, because of the medium they're using and because of what the hell is going on in this film in the first place. There's very little to hang on to tell you when you are. There's very little that tells you where you are either, really. There's not much Portugal up front in this movie. A lot of people are going to find this boring. I will say that right now.
Yep.
But I really didn't. I was very impressed. But you said you were less impressed the second time?
Well, I mean, yeah, because that's what's interesting about it. I mean, I'll be interested in actually hearing your thoughts posthumously, if you will, when you see it a second time. Because the first time I saw this, I had no idea what was going to happen. I had no idea what I was watching, really, other than the fact it was Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And the simplicity and the bare-bones nature of the whole thing completely blew my mind.
Yeah.
But not only that, to be fair, it's also a film about space and time, basically. Like, give a man space to come to terms with his crimes, you can literally see Henrique's inner workings and his struggles during this movie. Like, you're just watching his face. You're almost watching his forehead for the entire fucking movie. Like, my favourite scene of all is when Henrique goes to the forest quite early on.
Mm.
And he lies down on the first thing he does is when he gets there, he lies on the ground. Mm-hmm. Now, is this him grounding himself to his new reality? Is it perhaps him reenacting the positions of the bodies that he left behind when he committed his felony? Who knows? Mm. And yet again, as with Monstre, so much interpretation to be had here. He may or may not have a mental illness. He's got a speech impediment, but, you know, quite a few people do that are absolutely sane in the head and don't go blowing people up with guns. So has he or has he not got an illness? We don't know. He may actually, and this is the key thing, Ben, he may or may not actually be a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, clearly, what he's done in this film is not in doubt. It's not a nice thing to do.
It's not, but...
But what drove him? We don't really know. We don't really know who he shot. We have an idea, but we're not into... You know, potentially it could be an ex-wife, some sort of authority figure that's kind of forbidding him from seeing his daughters. But again, like with Monstre and like others, like with all great films, there's room for interpretation and no opinion is necessarily right or wrong. The film for me, as I said previously, hits the sweet spot. It's 1 hour 20 to 1 hour 40. You don't need a single minute longer on this film. It doesn't outstay its welcome whatsoever. And for me, in general, it remains, despite it having less of an impact because I knew the simplicity was coming, I knew the bare-bones nature of it was coming, it does take some of it away slightly, but it still remains, you know, a masterclass of capturing the simplicity of a movie, Ben. Yeah.
And the experience of Henry. Well, rather than, because so many films are obsessed with the what's happening, they're not really interested in how it's happening or how it feels when it's going on. And Alva is a film entirely made up of how this is feeling, or how these experiences are impacting him.
I mean, it's essentially one man's face one entire body and the entire forest. And the noise of those surroundings. Four things in this film. And that, so when he goes back to his little town slash village afterwards, and the car was his bike, I actually jumped out my seat. I was like, oh my God, so that's noise?
Yeah. No music. That's a lovely thing.
It is a nice thing. It
really is. What do you make of the ending, second time round?
I actually haven't thought about it. I'm just kind of formulating my, revisiting my overall opinion of it. I like it. I still like the ending because, again, it's open to all things.
Yeah.
It's time and space again, isn't it? Where I think all the people in the bar that he went to, in the cafe, they'd rather him not be there. They know that he's kind of going to be chased and looked for by the police. He himself probably knows that, which is why he's dressed in his absolute best.
Yep.
But he also, I think there's also a part of him that thinks he's got nothing to hide anymore.
And what's like, that POV about? What's that wondering?
That?
Yeah.
I can't work out because you've basically spent the entire film on Henrique's, in his pocket, on his shoulder almost, yeah. Or on a third person view, just like with him staring at the creases of his forehead. Then it goes POV. Not entirely sure about that, Ben, to be honest.
Okay. Just curious. If listeners have any ideas about this,
please let us know. But actually, isn't it nice that we don't understand everything though?
Yeah, gotcha.
Because I mean, if we're able to read, this is a director's debut, by the way. So if we're able to fully understand our director's intentions with his first film, then I think he's going to have a very predictable and sodden career. Really,
we've come through three of these now.
Yeah.
These debut films.
So that's a hell of a thing as well. Hell of a thing. Says a lot about European cinema and the future it has, which is obviously very good. Alva is Alva. Right. What are we on to next? One to Ridge, Ben, which I think, even in amongst all of the one-wordy titles in this list, this is the worst movie title in the entire list and potentially the worst movie title of the podcast history. But what is it anyway?
So Ridge is a film called Seasons. In Swedish, which was changed to Ridge for some reason that no one understands. It is a film about people who live on the periphery, which I think is where they're going with Ridge. Like they live on the ridge or over the ridge or something like that. It's another directorial debut. It's a film about people who live on a farm and people who are visiting a farm.
Yep.
And it's a film that has no real story whatsoever. And it's difficult to identify whether it's a piece of fiction or a piece of documentary because it kind of there's a Venn diagram here, which is where Ridge lives. It lives in the middle of this kind of fiction documentary film. You see the kind of the daily workings of people, the tasks they do every day. You see these in minute detail. You see machinery and you hear machinery again. We have very little, if any, music. Is there any music in this film, or is it? It's all just natural sound, isn't it?
Pretty much natural, yeah.
Yeah. So you get the sounds of the machinery, the sounds of people talking and walking. There's very, very little dialogue for you to follow. There's a haircut scene, which is the kind of dramatic highlight of the film. there are a few parties in the film as well. But you never really learn about any of the relationships between any of these people whatsoever. Most of them are not professional actors. These are amateurs, they're friends of the directors who are just turning up for the day. It's a hell of an experience. It reminds me very much of a film which I forgot the title of when we first did this, and I've bloody gone and done it again, haven't I? Oh, God, Sweetgrass. That was it. It's very, very similar to a film called Sweetgrass. If anyone saw Sweetgrass, Ridge is very much along those lines.
Mm.
I really loved it. I really loved it second time. I think this is a film that I'm going to come back to time and time again. In an age where we're all, well, not all, none of the films we've spoken about are obsessed with CGI and all this kind of stuff.
But
in an era when we're all focusing on films that are big CGI, colorized monsters, where there's nothing of the real world left, we're just watching cartoons, basically, about worlds we wished we lived in. I've got a lot of time for a film like Ridge, which is in the here and the now and shows you where we live. I like this kind of thing. It's an art installation movie, perhaps,
yep,
rather than a cinema experience as well. If, you know, if anyone's thinking, come on, Ben, get to the story, well, there isn't one. So, you know,
deal. It's the most divisive film on the list by far, and it's not even close. I mean, the thing about a list like this that we've slaved away all year putting together for you, don't forget that, is that whilst it's nice to agree on absolutely everything, what's more important is that we actually understand why either of us have actually put a film forward for this list. Otherwise, what is the point? So, you know, whilst Ridge is not my choice, and it never, ever would have been, whilst it's not, spoiler alert, my film of the year, I also can't sit here and say I don't understand why you like it, and I can't sit here and say I don't understand why you put it forward for this list. Because as much as it's the most divisive film on the list, it's also the most original.
Absolutely.
It's quirky, it's different, it's got a brief, and John Skoog sticks to that brief. Corn porn, you bet. PowerPoint, absolutely. Both of those things, it succeeds at. I've got nothing else to say, however.
Doozies. Do you know, just occurring to me, his name, Skoog, that's very close to the Norwegian for forest. Interesting.
Now I'm disappointed. Oh, I wonder if I can edit back in a link where I said from the forest to a Skoog with Alva to hear.
All the Scandinavian listeners would like that one.
I'm afraid I will not do that. I'd rather accept failure as what it is. Take that, left-wing people. Right, let's move on to Pihu.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a little bit surprised I put this forward for this list. I didn't expect it. However, the more
we both put it forward. This was a hell of a thing.
Yeah,
the
more I think about it, the more it deserves it. It's an Indian horror film. It's about a very, very young child who is left to her own devices in an apartment after her mother fails to wake up from the night before. And the film's also about her father's frantic journey to get back home to reach her before potential disaster strikes. Ben, what I try to do every year on this list is to have my personal biggest surprise of the year. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll even leave a great film out because it didn't surprise me as much as a film. Mm-hmm. I've actually got two major surprises on this list. So that's a record in itself. This is the first of them. It's automatically my favourite ever Indian film.
Yeah,
because I'm just not a Bollywood fan at all. And the reason it's that is because it's so authentic and its plausibility completely won me over throughout, basically.
Yeah.
Now, because of the genre, it's seeming, to be fair, is a lot lower than a lot of the films on this list. But actually, for me, it does a better job at reaching its potential than quite a few of them. Every possible reason that Pihu gets herself in danger, gets herself out of danger, gets herself in the position of harming herself, and getting herself out of the position of harming herself, as well as the reasons why the father can't get back from work so quickly, are all followed in the most perfect way. It all follows its own logic, and that is why this film is on this list for me. You get something out of this, just in a general summary, if you've got kids. That goes without question, because I think it's a nightmare scenario for any parent, this. But actually, it works for those that don't, because the horror is very much real anyway. Pihu, Ben, is without question the best horror film I've seen this year, and it's not even bloody close.
No. I would also like to add that I've just come back from Nepal, where I've been for 4 weeks. And I met a lot of people. And have talked a lot about films, and something that I've learned about that I really didn't know anything about this at all, so everyone feel free to laugh at me, was that Indian cinema is not all about Bollywood.
Indeed, not.
That was a big surprise.
But we don't see anything but the Bollywood. That is the problem. Don't,
but what a lot of people were talking to me about out there, because Indian cinema is very big in Nepal, so they were all into it. And Bollywood is very big, but also what's big over there is South Indian cinema, which is a genre that I hadn't heard of whatsoever. So South Indian cinema is not Bollywood. South Indian cinema is a kind of rawer, grittier, socially conscious kind of cinema, which I don't know if Pihu is technically a part of South Indian cinema, but I kept saying to people, oh, have you ever seen a film called Pihu? Does this qualify? Because please, it's the only Indian film I've seen for a very long time. Someone help me out here. And I've been looking, the company who made Pihu, they also made another film called The Sky is Pink, which was very popular over in Nepal. A lot of people were talking about this. And I'm not sure. I think this might fall in under the title of South Indian cinema, because it's not Bollywood. It's one of these kind of like roarer, I'm doing bunny ears around it, kind of movies, which, you know, this is learning for me. I'm an old man and I'm still learning about cinema, things that I thought I knew.
We all do.
We're all learning. But, you know, so some of us think we've got nothing left to learn. You know, so some of us think we know everything about what a Star Wars film should have been. And then some of us...
Why are you bringing Star Wars into this podcast, Ben? Back yourself.
Because it's horrible. I can't tell you. It's just awful.
I've mentioned The Irishman. You've mentioned the Star Wars. Let's leave American cinema out the rest of the podcast from now on.
Fair doozy. But I just find it so tiresome that we've come so far and we're in the age of information and all we're doing is arguing about ridiculous fictional canon cartoons.
Yep.
I don't want to live on this planet anymore if that's what we're going to do all the time.
So
Pihu, this was different. There's another film that we watched. I can't remember what it was, but the limitations of how they had to make this film are visible at the edges of the frame. You can see the limitations of how you make a film with a 2-year-old child. There are choices that you have to make where you can't make a child do certain things.
No.
So you have to work around it. An obvious example of that is looping. So a lot of the dialogue in this film that Pihu speaks is looped or ADR'd onto the film. It's not her live dialogue at the time of filming because you can't do that kind of thing. So the limitations are there, but come on, guys, we're making a film with a 2-year-old and it's terrifying. So those limitations will be there. Pihu had me on the edge of my seat.
Yep.
It was amazing. It was really well done. I didn't realize first time watching it that was Pihu's mother lying dead on the bed as well.
Well, we can say that when you mentioned that you don't want to live on the planet anymore, Ben, she definitely didn't want to live on the planet anymore.
But can you imagine being 2 years old and having your mother lying there pretending to be dead?
But again, it all makes perfect sense. As a 2-year-old, you'd think that. And actually, when you learn about why the mother topped herself, that also makes sense as well. But it's actually a real shock, though, isn't it? Because you sort of just think, oh, well, she's had a party. Maybe she's had a bit too much to drink. Maybe she's just died in her sleep of natural causes. No.
She took the easy way out, knowing that she was leaving a 2-year-old alone in the apartment.
I mean, you tell me a darker thing than that in horror films this year. I'd like to hear it.
It's been a bad year for horror films.
It has, but thankfully all is well with this one that's kind of trumped everything else anyway.
Then the ending as well. What an intense ending. As well, when I watched this, I had Mrs. Ben and my youngest daughter in the room, but most of the time they just ignore me when I'm watching my weird movies. Just like, oh, Dad's watching one of his weird.
They don't ignore you just in life generally, do they? Is it just movies?
No, just when I'm watching my movies. But this was a movie that slowly won over everyone in the room. Everyone took their headphones off and stopped their reading and fiddling around on electronic devices. And everyone was watching the last like 40 minutes of this movie as it kind of accelerated. And that, you know, that's not an easy thing to do in this day and age. You're not going to put an Indian film on and slowly your teenagers are going to be entranced by what's going on. Now, Pihu's a hell of a thing.
It really is. And you've mentioned the ending. Of course, we'll have to mention it one more time. You know, it is my favourite ending of the year by far. You know, it's Spielberg or Scorsese. Oh, there we go again. Yeah. That's my fault, Ben. I'm sorry. But if either of those two had nailed an ending to one of their films as good as this, bloody hell, the press would never stop talking about it. This is a world-class ending for a movie. It's just perfection. Like, you know, only the intermittent flashing lights of a powered-out apartment, a flashing blue police car lights, and a scream, and somebody under a bed. Come on.
Yeah.
Oh, beat and that. I can confirm. Fucking beat that. Anybody, anything, anywhere. You know.
Yeah. Those power cuts are rife, by the way. They happen all the frickin' time.
Exactly.
I'm so glad I went to Nepal with a torch in my pocket.
And how many times did you hide under the bed in Nepal, Ben?
Well, there wasn't much room under the bed. So not very often. I did look under it and one time and found a ring. That was exciting. That was a big highlight. But yeah, there was a time when there was a power cut, and the power cut happens kind of like in Pihu. It knocks out certain parts of the room first. So I was boiling a kettle at the time and the power cut hit where the kettle was plugged in. So I had to move it to another plug. And then eventually the power cut hit there as well. until finally I had the kettle plugged into the only plug left working in the room. And I had to hold the kettle on my hand because it was a plug about 5.5 feet up in the air. And yes, so I was holding the kettle as it's boiling, just getting to the boiling point when everything shut down in the entire region. The whole, everything just went black and silent. And I had this almost boiling kettle in my hand. That was an exciting moment. Yeah, but, torching them out.
Just the idea of you going under a bed finding a ring—that's a trilogy for most people. So it was
a wild time.
If there's any budding directors out there, you've got yourself an Amazon series right there. So film number 5 of 8. We're getting through these at a reasonable rate of knots.
We do have some more.
However, Dear Etrange. Now, this is the only film that we both had as film of the week, Ben.
Wait, didn't we both put Pee-hoo through as well?
Nope, that was my pick. You went with other things. But right. Dear Etrange was your pick for this list, but as I say, we both had it as film of the week. What have we got, Ben, with it? What have we got with Dear Etrange?
Dear Etrange is an interesting film. It's a film that you might think you've seen before. It's about a 40-year-old man whose wife is pregnant, and he has to announce this news to his the children from his first marriage, which you would think is a really straightforward thing. But Dear Etrange complicates all of this by looking at this kind of very unusual. This was my introduction to the social structure of step families in Japan, which in no way is similar to step families here. So in the West, you've got step families where everyone is kind of mixed together, and people have holidays together. There's a lot of fighting sometimes, and then there isn't. Whereas in Japan, what happens is you leave a family behind and you move on to the next one, and then you cut off all connection to the family you had before, which might seem odd to us, but you know, who are we to question these things? That's how they do it there. And that's what we're looking at with Dear Etrange. We're looking at a man who's trying to build connections to his previous family, which is not really a done thing. While moving on with his existing one. It's also a film about hot dogs.
Oh, really? I wasn't personally going to bring that up, but now that you have, we'll have to talk about it in a bit. Carry on.
And this is the way that I keep describing this film is this is a film about the moments when your life falls apart, when you are filling a glass of water. Whereas a lot of films concern themselves with the kind of the big events, the loud events in life, the bits where people are shouting at each other and things are crashing into each other. Dear Etrange is a film about the very, very small moments, about changing a lock on a door, about cleaning a kitchen.
Or not eating cherries that are your favourite fruit.
Or not eating cherries. It's about all of these, like, the tiny moments that make up a family's existence, and kind of allows them to resonate, and they get louder and louder and louder as this film goes on. This is it's a really, really interesting film. It's not showy in any way. No. It's very low key. Performances are low key. Nothing about this film is loud and in your face whatsoever, apart from the choice of lettuce on a hot dog, because it's quite a lot of lettuce.
We will talk about that very shortly.
Okay. I really like this film. I find it deeply moving. It's a very moving experience. It's in a period when we're discouraged from empathizing with other people. This film forces you to empathize with a large number of different people within the family structure, looking at things from every point of view, looking at things from the point of view of a teenager, of a deadbeat dad, of a responsible dad, of an ex-wife. You're forced into how they're seeing things and how everything is impacting on them. It's a hell of a thing.
It really is. And you've mentioned all the filmy stuff quite nicely. So thank you for that. The three remarkable things that I will never forget for the rest of my days regarding this film are, number one, when Japanese women give birth, all family members who isn't giving birth have to wait outside a shut door.
Yeah.
Love that. Yeah. Number two, Japanese department stores have an area where little kids can drive around in coin-operated cars, and I actually mean proper cars that can be driven with coins. Not that kind of shit that we get in this country that just shake you from side to side and up and down. These are actual cars you can drive for kids with coins. Amazing. But the revelation of the whole year, you've mentioned it a couple of times already. I know you're itching to come back on it as well. without a doubt, is the fact that Japanese have hot dogs with ketchup and mustard, fine, resting on a piece of lettuce.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of lettuce as well.
And if you see where they put the if you see where they put the ketchup and the mustard, they have little alternating dots of it all along the leaf of the lettuce.
Yes.
So it's not even on the hot dog.
No, it's like they've got ladybirds running up the lettuce.
Films of the year have been given to a lot less than that, Ben.
Yeah. I mean, but then this film is long. It breaks your rule for how long a film should be.
It is long. Mm-hmm. And it did have a little bit of a less full impact the second time round, where some other films had a stronger impact.
Okay.
But it's a unique Japanese film. And why call it unique? You get all your normal things like great kids acting. I mean, the kids are perfect in this film as usual. But there are no histrionics in this movie. There are not even any particular moments of heightened drama. You've nailed all that very nicely when you said it's low key. That's exactly what it is. And so many Japanese films, even ones that have won Film of the Year on this podcast, I wouldn't call any of them low key. This is a very low key, but still equally as dramatic film. And it's actually re-educated myself about expectations of Japanese cinema now. I mean, I love it anyway for the most part. We'll always continue to do it on this podcast when I can, if I get a chance to. But it doesn't have to be so heightened all the time.
No.
I mean, there's so many low key scenes in this movie that you've mentioned already. It just works really well. And my actual favourite scene is the very first scene, Ben. You stare at all of this colour on a sort of playgroundy kind of public area. And that's as much colour as you see in the entire film is the very first scene. And then it literally cuts from that to the same child that you see running on this colourful playground. And it is, by the way, a very colourful playground. It's a rainbow, basically. She then gets into some sort of cable car that's on a Ferris wheel, like the London Eye, but not the London Eye, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it literally cuts from the colourful playground to how would you feel if your mother would have a baby to a different father? Mm-hmm. It literally goes from one to the other just like that. And mm-hmm. the colour stock, like there's a sort of greyish blue to the whole thing. It's amazing. It's very, very brave, and it sets the stall out for what the rest of the films is going to be, which is fascinating and interesting and nevertheless the best Japanese film of the year without question.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, Dear Etranger, recommended by all. And as I say, one of the few times that we can both name the same film of the week. We didn't have that problem when it came to Petra, Ben.
No, if I remember rightly, we did not have that problem.
But we're here. We are here with Petra. It's on the list. Yes. What is Petra, Ben? What is it about?
Well, okay. So Petra's a film about an artist. Her name is Petra. She's played by Barbara Lenny. And as time goes on, I'm starting to come to the conclusion that you can put Barbara Lenny in pretty much any film, and I'm going to vote it Film of the Week. I really like Petra. Barbara Lenny. I'm a big fan. I want to see much more from her. In this time when we're all obsessed with Penelope Cruz and Scarlett Johansson and people who can't act to save their life, Barbara Lenny comes along and she's astonishing. Manages to hold.
But she don't look half as good as that. That's the problem.
Well, this is
not a problem for me, but a problem for other people.
Everyone is mind-bendingly shallow, and they just go, "Oh, she's a really good actress," because they find someone pretty.
It helps,
but other than looking at whether or not they can act, it drives me nuts. Mm. Anyway, so Petra is taking a residency in this estate run by this artist, how do you pronounce his name? Is it Haumi? Haumi? Xiaomi?
Heme.
This kind of old artist guy. Yeah. He's opened up his space to residencies. She comes in to do a residency. And as the film goes on, you discover that the reason she's there is because she thinks that Heme is her father. And she wants to get to the root of this. Then hilarity ensues as a lot of lies are covered up. I mean,
there is no hilarity in this movie.
No, there isn't. And this is why you don't like it, but this is why I love it, because I really love it when a film will take a kind of no holds barred look at grief or emotions. Or I really like it. It makes me feel grown up when a film sits down and goes, you know what? Sometimes people feel horrific and that's fine. But the reason that this film made my Film of the Week and the reason that I enjoyed it so much the second time around is that it's got a real intention in how it's made, in where the camera goes and where it doesn't go, in what you see and what you don't see. This film thinks about it, and I will say this, I think this film thinks about these things more than any of the other films that we have listed. I know that not everyone loves this movie, and I know that it's not 100% successful either. I guess it does fall into some kind of like melodrama areas, but it's really, really thinking about how it's made. Quite vociferously. There's a big push here on where the camera's looking, where it's not looking, when it moves and when it doesn't. I was very excited by how this film was made, and Barbara Lennie as well. Those are the two things that I loved about this film. I mean, you just like get Barbara Lennie reading the phone book. I'll probably watch it, see how that goes. But I know that this film's kind of bleak tone didn't strike a chord with you, right?
Well, initially, no. But to be fair, to actually sit through this film again, I had to change my entire mindset. That was the only way it was going to be possible. So whilst I was watching, I was thinking, misery, 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 misery. And guess what, Ben? It worked.
Tell me more.
I'm at a stage now where I can happily say, I think Petra is a decent film. It threatens to be better than that. But what I will say overall is this. Do not watch this film in December, and do not watch this film in January.
Well, because it's too dark, too bleak,
lots
too cold.
Of potential incest.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of suicide, lots of death, and above all else, misery.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is an upsetting film. It is miserable. There's a lot of kind of upbeat moments for me as well. The relationship that Petra builds with spoiler alert, what turns out to be her brother, is really sweet. It's really nice to see someone like go through a lot of pain, a lot of questioning themselves, a lot of thinking about who am I, and then to kind of open themselves up to a relationship with someone.
Yeah, I mean, what you've mentioned previously, and actually you've got it wrong why I dislike the film above all else. Now that I'm in the frame of mind of misery, I'm fine with the film. The reason I don't like the film goes against something that you like about the film when you talked about it on the actual episode itself, and that is what the film doesn't tell you that you really, really enjoyed, because the film doesn't tell you a lot. You really have to kind of piece everything together. My big problem with this film, having seen it all the way through this time properly in the right frame of mind, is that when the film starts to tell you things that it lets itself down for me badly. And I'm not quite sure why that decision was taken for it to do, for example, chapters. And not only chapters, but to put them all in different orders. And not only to have chapters in different orders, but to have the chapter tell you exactly what's going to happen in the next, 15, 20 minutes or so.
Yes.
Don't agree with it. It completely ruins the drama for me. When you've got a chapter that says, this is what happens when X happens, Y happens, and it actually does happen, and there's no deviation from that happening. And you think, well, what was the point of you telling me? Yeah. Give a chapter a title, Von Trier style or something, just a one-word kind of beige thing that doesn't really have any resemblance to what you're about to watch. Be that clever if you want to be Jaime Rosales. Don't, however, go the other way and literally list exactly what's going to happen in the next 20 minutes of my viewership, because it ruins it.
Well, you see, I think he's mainly interested in how this is unfolding rather than what is unfolding. All of his kind of like technical camera choices tell me that he's confident enough to tell you what's going to happen, because he's not really interested in hanging everything on the what so much as the how that's going as to where that camera is going to stop. And whether the people are going to continue moving or stay standing in the frame. He's kind of interested in how he's putting it together. But I see your point.
But that'd be fine, in which case I feel excluded because I'm not part of his toy box that he's got in front of him.
Yeah.
You've got to tell a story in this thing, in a reasonable way. And like another example of putting things in the wrong order. One example of that jarred with me the most was, I think it was the one after the chapter after Lucas, I think, who blows his brains out with a shotgun in a field somewhere. Then, after that moment happens, has a chapter where they go back in time to show the blossoming romance between Lucas and Petra. We don't need to know that. We know that they liked each other. We've just seen him kill himself. Why do you then want to go back and show the relationship blossoming? We do not need to be told that. Again, it's what you decide to tell us. Javier Rosales that ruined the film for me. I don't need to be told that they loved each other. I worked it out for myself. It was very obvious. They had a thing, potentially incestuous, but nobody really knew at that point. They were really quite into each other for quite a while. He blows his brains out. Move on to something else. Do not go back to tell me that they loved each other, because it just doesn't work.
Fair doozies.
But that's all on the director, which is why I don't want to watch any more of his films if I can help it, because he's not even an inexperienced guy. So,
he's not busy. This is like his second film or something,
so,
right?
So, you know, God knows what his first film was like. I'll leave that to you to watch. but yeah, apart from that, performances were fine. Of course they were. You know, your favourite, she's fine too. But a few too many niggles for this for me. A few too many niggles that just kind of pile up on each other. And again, I am not interested in Jaime Rosales' toy box. He's not interested in mine. I'm not interested in his. Which is why I'd like to move on now, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. we can't possibly have more films to discuss.
That's one more.
Oh,
we've done a fair old whack and we're nearly at the end of it all. Right.
Yeah.
Lazzaro Felice, otherwise known as Happy as Lazzaro. It's an Italian film directed by the German-sounding Alice Rohrwacher. About a family of crop sharers, a.k.a. slaves, better to understand that way, who live illegally on the estate of the De Luna family, working tobacco fields and other goods for the De Luna family. Lazzaro, one of the young workers, becomes friendly with Tancredi, who is the son of the De Luna empire. They eventually strike a kind of kinship, if you will, and Tancredi decides he prefers the poorer way of living, the poorer lifestyle, and he escapes to the hills, faking a kidnapping in order to get money from his rich mother. Meanwhile, a daughter of the De Lunas eventually rings the police for that kidnapping reason, which results in all the workers being released / rescued and taken to the police station in town, apart from Lazzaro, who has since fallen down a very steep cliff, Ben. Fast forward, I think a dozen or so years, he wakes up, not having aged even a tiny bit, eventually finds some of his old family in the city, and tries to piece his old life back together. Mm. That's the longest synopsis I've ever given for a film, and it needed to be.
It's a long.
But it's the only way it can make sense. Where to start with this one? For me, this is also a hell of a thing. And I've already mentioned surprises. This is my second biggest surprise of the year for me, Ben. May even be the number one surprise for me. It's a film about the proletariat.
Yeah.
It's anti-capitalist and, for the most part, left-leaning, none of which I agree with whatsoever, and yet it doesn't stop me loving this movie, of which I do very much. It touches on the class divide of Italy very well, what I know about having lived there and worked there myself.
Yeah.
Lazzaro himself is the performance of the year for me, actually. He plays a really suggestible but also completely innocent chap. He just can't take your eyes off at any point, and he manages to sustain that character in every scene, every second of each scene. The director, for me, does a great job playing the role of one of the older children later on, who turns into an adult, Antonia. Mm-hmm. She plays the role of her well, but everybody ages apart from Lazzaro, which is a bizarre, bizarre thing. You don't expect it. But by that point, you kind of accept this like magic realist world that I'm okay with magic realism. How about you, as a general kind of rule in movies? You know,
I'm not crazy with magic realism.
No, anymore, I'm not madly crazy on it. But the reason I don't mind it in this film, A, because it's an Italian film.
Yeah.
And the reason why it's important for Italian cinema is that this is a country that, of course, believes in Romulus and Remus. You know, the founders of the city of Rome were somehow mothered by a she-wolf. So if they believe that, I'm happy to believe that they believe that and go along with any magic realism they have in any of their movies. And of course, what's in this movie all the way through? Wolves. So that fits in very, very nicely indeed. Thank you very much. And the city that all the family end up being moved to looks suspiciously like Rome to me. In fact, I'm fairly sure it is Rome. So it all ties up nicely. More to be said, Ben, I think, but I'll let you come in now because this is actually the first time you've seen it. So I ask you the question. Yeah. Ben Felice?
This was interesting. I watched two films since coming back from Nepal, this and Alva.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in the mood for a huge amount of plot and dialogue. And so Alva hit me really happily. And then Happy as Lazzaro, I kind of need to see again. I loved the look. The Super 16 look, again, it was really nice watching two back-to-back movies that were both shot on 16mm. This has an artsier look to it with a 16mm. Alva has a kind of like handheld timeless kind of look. This has more in line with something like The Wild Boys, which we watched last year.
Absolutely, good show.
It's got this kind of like, it almost feels like it's taking place inside a snow globe, this film. It also felt to me a lot like a fairy tale.
Yep.
I feel like we were getting a kind of Italian social realist story about land ownership and tobacco plantation seen through the kind of, let's say, snow globe lens of a fairy tale.
Wobulus Remulus.
Yeah, things don't always make sense. People sleep for a long time and don't age.
One person does, all the rest do.
Yeah. People from the high and the lower ends of society come together and form bizarre friendships and plots and stuff. I need to see this again. I was very tired when I watched this, and a lot of things were happening. But it was a surprise. That's pretty much all I got to say about it. This was not the standout of the week for me. But I can see why other people like it. When I was watching this, I was like, Theo's going to love this film. It's got all the kind of Italian political, social aspects going on that he absolutely loves.
I don't agree with this point of view, and yet it still doesn't deter me. Whereas if you put me in front of a British film to watch this exact political point of view, forget it, Ben.
Yep, I feel
that. That's quite obvious to a lot of people.
It's about Lazzaro. The Peter Sellers film Being There?
Okay.
Every now and then you get these films where you get a central character who's kind of like an ingenue. They don't really have much to say. They're quite innocent and wide-eyed. And people read into that experience a lot more going on behind the eye. So, Being There is a film where everyone thinks Peter Sellers is a genius. He just wanders around looking at things all the time. And Lazzaro kind of reminded me of that Peter Sellers Being There character.
Well, in the reverse, because everyone thinks he's a dumb fuck, and then he actually starts to identify herbs that nobody else knew you could eat. So he's actually a genius, you know.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
So Peter Sellers in reverse. Put that on the DVD for this film.
He's a black guy. Because Peter Sellers ends up being a gardener and Being There as well. Hold on.
There you go.
Wait, is Lazzaro Felice Italian for Being There?
No. It literally translates as happy as Lazzaro. That's why I said Ben Felice is Ben happy with this movie. Relatively happy with it, by the sound of it. It's a fucking left wing thing. But I love how kind of even in the end, it's kind of like we believe in capitalism to the very, very end, despite of what it actually means.
Yeah.
Like we believe that if you go to the bank, you can get results. And my favourite scene, for example, my favourite scene in this entire movie, and one of my favourite scenes of the whole year, were it not for the PU ending, it probably would be the number one scene of the entire list for me, is when they meet up with Tancredi again, and they go to his mansion, his apartment, if you will. And they go there in their finest clothes, and they take in some very expensively bought pastries because they still believe in the Delunas. They still believe that they mean something, and the Delunas themselves still believe that they have value in society, even though they literally live in an apartment where people came out smoking weed. But still, it's the Delunas. They meant something. And to be asked to go to lunch with Tancredi and his what remains of his family is still a thrill for these workers. So they put the finest clothes on. They go to a really expensive patisserie and buy a load of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the reality hits. But still, they believed and they were happy to leave those pastries with them because they felt they were in the company of somebody special. It is just such a beautiful, wonderful, legitimate scene. I just completely fell in love with all the characters at that point, even though I really, really shouldn't love any of them, or particularly the poorer family. But so many great moments for me in this film. And it's actually reignited my interest in Italian cinema now, because some of it is so stuck in the old ways.
When did your love of Italian cinema disappear? Oh, a second.
Well, it went a long time ago. Because we only ever kind of get like the Oscar-y stuff, and it's just not none of them are really touching what I want them to touch. But equally, I do like the kind of Fellini era. So I moan about them going back to the old era, and then when they go back to the old era, I moan about it. So don't pay too much attention to that. It's a weird, weird thing. But this film, for the fact that a left-wing film can get me so endeared to people, is a miracle. It's a proper Christmas miracle. and this film, and Alice herself, Alice Rohrwacher, or Wacker, I believe her, She's made a couple of films before that have gone quite well. So I'm going to start tracking her now, I think. She knows how to put a film together. She can make magic realism work, as long as she keeps it to Italian culture and stuff, which she obviously will. I enjoyed it a hell of a lot, as I say. And but the overall thing, like another final scene that I want to briefly mention before we actually come to the result of this thing, is the bit in the church where the music was escaping from the church.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and the line is, you know, music is dead, was said by somebody. And it's just such a perfect thing where, you know, the banks can't help you. Religion kind of throws you out. Music is dead. Italian society is dead. So it's almost as if you've started on the left wing of the spectrum and now you're just coming into the centre where it's like, you know what? Nobody's good anymore in Italy. Mm-hmm. Nobody can help us. Nobody cares. Which I think is more of a reality to things than the left-wing point of view anyway.
Yeah.
So, and that's just not in Italy, across the world probably. So, wow. Nice message about your own country, but one that's probably accurate for Italy anyway, having been there and experienced it myself. So, Ben,
yeah.
Get your prop ready.
Okay.
The listeners don't know about this yet, but they will soon hear it. We are about to announce the winner. We've come to an agreement. We've had an agreement, which is what it's about, of course. We need to have an agreement on these things.
Meeting of minds.
Democracy has spoken. And the winner of the 2019 Outside Centre Film Podcast Film of the Year is... Alva. Let's let that play out for a bit. Listen to those beautiful echoes of the ball from Nepal.
Oh, yeah.
Alva won.
Alva. And Film of the Year. Who would have thought it?
Now, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Initially, I was a bit surprised. But then you can take second viewings far too seriously for me.
Yeah.
You really, really can. And the simple fact of the matter is, three people have reviewed this film now on this podcast. All of us loved it first time round. What else matters?
Damn.
What else matters? And this is why I am secretly glad that it won, even though I had a different top two to this. And that is, at the time of recording, the lowest ever IMD rating for Film of the Year winner on this podcast.
Yeah.
This film, 4.3 out of 10.
Yeah. You cannot find a review written in English on the internet. It doesn't exist.
And yet they've still got hundreds, thousands of votes. Average it out at 4.3 out of 10 for this movie. Now, we know IMDb is a database. The clue's in the title, sweethearts. It's not a great review website, but people do often get confused with the two. And it's newsworthy for me. 4.3 out of 10. Now, on the one hand, I can see why people would automatically turn off and go, oh, God, nothing happens. But this is why we exist. This film is why we do the podcast. Because what happens is, as I say, you've had three people this year on this thing tell you Alva's a great film and probably look out for it as Film of the Year list, which it's ended up being and then ended up winning on.
Mm.
Are you going to listen to those three people or are you going to go onto IMDb, see that somebody was talking about Alva at some point, seeing that some people have given it 4.3 out of 10, and are you not going to watch it therefore?
That is
the point. So this, as I like to do so often, this is a film that justifies our existence on this damn podcast. So everybody go and watch Alva and have done with it and forget the ratings that you may have seen about it. You'll get. I find it difficult that some people wouldn't get something out of nearly all the films on the list, not all of them, but Alva. There's nothing like Alva.
No, there really isn't. I mean, when I put it forward for Film of the Year, I was deliberately leaving Ridge out because I thought Ridge and Alva kind of move in the same territories in this kind of like plotless, wordless existence in the countryside. So I had to think about which film I thought would resonate with people better, Ridge or Alva. And like, truth be told, I think Ridge is probably a film that I'm going to come back to time and time and time again. But I think for the broader picture, I think more people are going to fall in love with a film like Alva than a film like Ridge. Simply because it has a central character and a story.
So now we reveal the results, and it's actually the same as what happened last year. Winter Brothers was your number one and my number three.
Mm-hmm.
And Alva the same. Alva was your number one and my number three.
Hey.
So, again, nice symmetry.
Yeah. Oh, can't wait to see what the maker of Winter Brothers gets onto next, eh?
Well, that's a good time for... that is a segue of a podcast presenter, by the way. You should try it one day. But in the meantime, you're under me. Until you break out and do a Juliette Binoche special somewhere else.
Oh, yeah.
Or something. But Yes. What else have you enjoyed this year, Ben? We always like to do this before we end up. What did you enjoy outside of this dear podcast of ours? The rules are off. The shackles are broken. Something that you've watched that you've gone, you know what? If only we could have talked about it on the podcast this year.
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm really regretting is that I got to see a press screening of Vita Vita Darga, the follow-up film to Winter Brothers by Luna Parmesan.
Indeed.
And I really liked it. It hit me square in the center. If I've got any criticism at all to make about Winter Brothers, it would simply be that the central character is what you might call juvenile a little bit. He wheezes in public and he's obsessed with sniffing panties and stuff. And that's not to say that the film itself is juvenile in any way. It's just focusing on a central character who's a bit of a man child. Vita Vita Darga is about a man. Very strongly a man. Again, he does dumb things. Luna Parmesan isn't interested in people who make the correct choice all the time. But it's a very different central character. And it's also the only film... When I watch most films, like 94% of movies, I sit there thinking, why was this made? Why did you get all these people together and spend all of this money to tell this story and do this thing? What's the point? But when I was watching Vita Vita Darga, the thing that I kept thinking about was, how did you do this?
Yes.
How is this film made? Like this, it hurt my head thinking about how some sequences in that film were put together. How have you done this, Luna? Did you spend 5 years on this movie? There are aspects of it where the how it's done are just monumental. It's a big loping giant stumbling around the landscape again. He's doing exactly what he did in Winter Brothers, but and then some. And of course, everything is centered on this very, very mature, very much adult central character as well. So you don't have that kind of juvenile aspect anymore. Everything is very different in that respect. Really, really enjoyed A White, White Day. I would really recommend looking out for it in 2020 when it comes out in March, I think, in selected cinemas.
And you can bet your ass that me and Lee are going to do it at some point.
You better do it. You better. I want to be talking about it again in a year.
We shall see.
We will.
You have proven to be a fairly mediocre judge of film quality, Ben, other than Alva. So we shall see. Very interesting nonetheless. And actually, what it also needs to do is win the Edda Award for Icelandic Film of the Year. Winter Brothers didn't.
Yeah.
I don't think. So we'll be interested to see how the Icelandics themselves take it. I think that award is... I can't remember when that award comes out. I think it's one of the... Where does it fit into the Scandinavian calendar? I can't remember. I'm not going to guess. No point. But it is going to be... I think it's actually one of the later ones, like August or something. We find out whether it does win the Edda Award for that. But anyway, interesting stuff. Very briefly, mine as well. It's an old one now. Where do you sit on Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Ben? You're a music fan.
I'm not a big Nick Cave guy.
Right. Well, I think this will convert you. It's a documentary you did back in 2016, I think it is, called...
Days on the Earth.
It's the other one. It's One More Time with Feeling, I think it's called.
Oh, okay.
And it's about the making of the Skeleton Tree album from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Now, if you're not a fan of the music... that's going to be 50% of the thing in the dustbin. However, during the filming of this documentary is when he actually lost his son, who took a drug overdose and fell off a cliff.
Yes.
And that, you don't, obviously, thankfully, don't see it happen, but that starts to permeate itself into the documentary as he's making it, and Nick Cave essentially decides to carry on regardless and kind of give the documentary like the respect that it deserves. So the music does carry on, the recording goes on, but it then turns into... as you can probably imagine, a very intense look at grief procedure.
Which I'm all about.
Which is what Nick Cave is about anyway. His music has got that kind of quality to it. But it is, and I say this very, very concisely, the most fascinating and interesting look at grief I've ever seen documented.
Okay, interesting.
Now, it's at, and to the point where my... if I'm going to make three pledges, one is to do more Italian Romanian cinema. Number two, not watch any of your French films that you're going to put forward. And I said that in the episode a few episodes ago, and that's I'm sticking to that. If they're good enough, they'll reach the end of the year list, in which case I got no choice. But until then, no. My third pledge is to really look closely at grief in movies for 2020. Yeah. Uh-huh. There are no tears shed at any point during this documentary. Now, what do movies do better than anybody? Tears. It's all about showing Gru through tears. This is a man that literally a few months ago was having his son in the documentary himself, showing him how the studio was working. Then we fast forward to a few more chapters down the line. There is no more son. The son took an overdose and died. So you would think, therefore, a film would have tears at that point or something. There is no tears. And in fact, Nick Cave, during this entire piece, keeps saying, I think you're all waiting for this magical moment where I can tell you exactly how I'm dealing with it. Or you're waiting for a moment where I'm showing you how I'm dealing with it. And the reality is that when you actually go through a trauma like this, there is no way that you deal with it.
No.
You just deal with it. But you can't have that in movies. Because that isn't good enough for people. You need to have physical evidence or something of a decline in physical or mental state or something. Now, because of how real and true and raw the grief is in this particular documentary, and yes, it is a documentary, I'm aware of that, but it's nevertheless real. It's 100% real. So I am really now looking forward to seeing how movies deal with grief going forward. Because I will not tolerate tissues and tears.
No.
Because that is not, and particularly for men, it's not what grief is about. We deal with grief in an entirely different way. We don't have the chemical capability of producing tears on tap. We just don't. What we can do is deal with it in a man way, if you will, which is not necessarily the best way, but it is nevertheless a way.
Yeah, I read a lot of, when I did my postgraduate degree, I did my thesis dissertation was on crying and men in cinema. And I read a lot of scientific studies of crying and emotion and stuff. There's a lot to be said for the fact that the ability to pass tears, if you want, allows you to process grief in a lot better way. And not doing so can have some deeply negative impacts on you. But yeah, that it is a big manly thing.
So that alone I'd recommend this documentary for. Even if whether you like Nick Cave or you don't, whether you like his music or not, watch it for this, for the management of grief and the portrayal of grief, and it'll blow your minds.
I mean, I'm intrigued. Antichrist is my go-to grief movie. But I will include
that's
this.
That's a very different kind of grief.
But again, it's a grown-up movie about a couple who've lost their child. I'm all for like grown-up treatment of things.
Absolutely, as you've already said. So that is that, and we are now comfortably within the 1 hour 20, 1 hour 40 window, which obviously applies to podcasting as well as films.
That's right.
Although I think podcasting needs to be a lot shorter. That's up to me. But as you know, this is the flagship episode, so all the rules are off. But the rules are broken anyway. One more thing before we go, Ben, and you're listening to this. You're listening, but you're not participating. I would love to have got you in on this, but unfortunately, time permitted us
I'm going to eat a mint.
Indeed. Not to be able to get you involved, sadly, because of time. However, Film of the Decade. And this, you will laugh at the list thinking, what on earth is this list? Obviously, these are the only film of the year things that you need to care about anyway. So therefore, every film of the year that the podcast has ever given is now on a list for me to tell you what I, the only constant on the podcast, will announce as film of the decade for the podcast. Simple as that. And what do we have going back all the way into the present day? Computer Chess, Like Father, Like Son, Woodjob, Phoenix, God knows why that's on the list. Sweet Bean, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence, we all know why that's on the list. Mm-hmm. Ghost Story, why is it on the list? Princess Sid, why is it on the list? Sparrows, Winter Brothers, and of course, Alva. So, I thought about it for a few minutes. And, I mean, there's two Japanese films there which were fantastic. Very different in style as well. And, in fact, Koreeda's first film, which he's never bettered, Like Father, Like Son, is still the best Koreeda film. But for me, and it's not even difficult, actually. Alva made an impact for sure. Winter Brothers, The Fight Back of Scandinavia. Sparrows, Iceland being Iceland. But for me, without question, the film of the decade for this podcast has to be A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence. Ooh, like, Roy Anderson, you know, nobody's better placed to comment on a society of their country than him. He is the number one person in the world. He's 70-odd, he's seen it all, he's been there before, and when you actually watch his music career, good grief, when you watch his film career, that'll be an interesting, Roy Anderson and the something on stage. Roy Anderson in The Absurdists.
Electric Six, I'd watch that.
Absolutely. It's an absurdist humour that nobody else can quite manage like him. And it just works so well with beige Sweden. And as I say, when you watch his film career and you've seen he's only made three films before he made A Pigeon Sat on a Branch, everything was building up towards A Pigeon Sat on a Branch reflecting on existence. It got more absurdist as the career went on. It went darker, bleaker, but yet also more positive, more warming, which is why I'm excited, but also a bit concerned, Ben, that Roy Anderson has decided to make another movie, and it's probably going to be out next year. It should be out next year, almost certainly. We will obviously do it, but I just don't know. For film of the decade that he made that felt like the way to end his career, another film on top of that, it's like Haneke making at least two films, two more than he should have done. Maybe, I'm not sure how many new Anderson experiences are going to fit with me, because when you complete a trilogy, it's just brilliant. You know, it feels right, and Pigeon Sat on a Branch felt right at the time for him and just for cinema in general. So, not sure about the new one that's going to come out. Obviously, we'll do it and probably love it, but that's the film of the decade for me, Ben. And I'm assuming you've seen it, by the way.
Of course I've seen it, yeah. But funnily enough, someone recommended a movie to me earlier this year, which is called A Swedish Love Story. Have you ever seen that one?
Indeed, that's one of his early ones.
That's one of his early films, yeah. So I watched it completely unaware that it was made by the same Roy Anderson, and loved A Swedish Love Story. What a wonderful kind of vital, handheld 16mm experience that was. And what a funny career to move from that kind of thing to where he is now. I mean, for me, more than A Pigeon Sat on the Branch Reflecting on Existence, I was really hit by You the Living. I think You the Living is probably my favourite Roy Anderson film.
Maybe so.
They're all the same.
I mean, the first one is basically a love letter to Czech cinema. So put that one aside. He's entitled to have that opinion. Put that to one side. And you got those three that are similar in tone, but they just get more absurdist. Whereas actually, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch is actually quite balanced. Yes, you have absurdist moments, but you also have real moments. And it kind of just calms down a bit. As he's calming down, he's getting older, and it just everything makes sense with that movie for me. If we were around when You the Living, the podcast was around when You the Living come out, maybe it would have been different. But
it was a different decade, so
awesome stuff. So that is it. We've given you everything we can. There is nothing more to give, other than myself and Ben wishing you Happy New Year. And we'll see you on the other side.